Yes, we are recording. And I'm going to mute all. And you will not have the ability to unmute yourself. So until after the annual general meeting. So we'll be starting with our annual general meeting, as we do most Februarys. And following that, we'll have our main presentation. excuse me. So you do not have the ability to unmute yourself. So if you have any questions or comments, you can either hold them until the end of the AGM, in which case we'll open up for questions at that point, or you can enter them into the chat window if you want to, and we'll pick them up from there. So with that, I will share my screen again. And we'll kick off the annual general meeting, February 9, 2022. So on the agenda, we'll have the election results. We'll have board reports or information about the board reports. And then we'll open it up for questions and comments. So for the election, we had 9 nominations at the end of the nominating period, which was December 31. And so the following are acclaimed, which are all the existing board members who all stood for re-election. Nobody else stood for election. And so the 9 nominees are acclaimed as of this meeting. And I would like to thank Bob Hares, our election chair. Once again, he's had a terribly difficult job with us not having more nominations than positions, and therefore we do not have to have an actual election. For board reports, the president's report was in the January newsletter. The treasurer's report is in the February newsletter and will also be presented now by Alan. And the secretary's report from Gail is in the February newsletter. So, treasurer's report. Alan, unmute yourself and kick it off.
I am unmuted, so if you want to move to the first slide. Okay, so this is the big picture. The takeaway here is if you notice the expenses in red and the revenue in green are both down from historical levels over the last couple of years. And of course, that is all related to COVID-19 in that we haven't been holding meetings and we haven't been charging memberships. So that's where those differences come from. And if we go to the next one, you'll see the state of the financial world in numbers. And basically, we're in a good, healthy financial position. We've still got more than $17,000 available. However, if you look at the difference between revenue and expenses over the last year, you'll notice that we're in the red for the fiscal year. So we actually spent a bit more, almost $300 more than we took in 2021. And the details we'll show you in the next slide. So you can see that most of the revenue is $600 in membership income. And interestingly, most of that came before March 31st last year. We had $400 in memberships. And if you recall, that was because we were offering a 2-for-1 essentially, buy 1 year and get a second year free. So we had a raft of new memberships come in, and then we picked up some other memberships for the remaining part of the year. The expenses are basically 2 categories in the main. Internet cost is over $400. That's basically things like web hosting, domain name renewal, that sort of thing, the Zoom account. And then the meeting expense is largely speaker gifts. We give an honorarium to external speakers and non-board members, regular members of the club, who give presentations. So that's where our expenses have gone. And you see that we basically spent about $300 more than we took in, as I said. So the big picture then, again, the final slide here. We're basically holding our own in terms of money in the bank, and everything is well under control, I would suggest. And your board of directors is doing a good job. And that's it for me, unless there are any questions.
Yeah, what I'll do is I will do another mute all, if I can find my window for it. I can't force unmute people, but I can mute all, and I can allow people to unmute themselves. So if there are any questions, you can either enter them into the chat window, or you can unmute yourself now and ask Alan whatever you like. And it looks like we have no questions. We can cycle back because we will have questions at the end of the AGM as well. So if you have things about the treasurer's report, you could bring them up at that point as well. Okay, thanks a lot, Alan. So I would like to extend some thanks to some people. The 2021 board members certainly put in an awful lot of effort to keep things running. We have some assistance to the board of directors. So Mark Caillé decided years ago that he no longer wanted to be on the board, but he was willing to keep on the membership chair duties. And so he's been doing that very ably for many, many years. Richard Aylesworth has been doing financial review for us for quite a few years, and very detailed and very thorough financial review of the books. And there, I believe the February media newsletter has his comments on the review for the last financial year. And also Bob Harris, who has been sitting for a number of years as our election chair. So thanks to them. Presenters, I put these in order by chronological, that we saw them come in from the outside. Deed Reimer from the Victoria Pie Makers has given presentation. Mariana Ludmila Cortez gave a very interesting presentation on education in third world and things like that. And Tim Cole and Andrea Giron gave us a wonderful presentation from the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. I hope people caught that. It was really fascinating. In the OPCUG members, we had presentations from Alan German, Bridget Lord, myself, Linda Buskey, Stéphane Richard, Tom Trottier, and Bob Walker. Again, those are in chronological order. I didn't see any other way to order them that made sense. I would like to extend an additional thanks to Linda Buskey for designing and analyzing the member survey that we had on meeting venue. A lot of work went into that, and a lot of very good information was gleaned from that due to Linda's designing an excellent set of questions and doing the analysis after the fact. So thanks very much to Linda for that. Contributors to the newsletter, every month we have a packed newsletter, usually 8 pages long, of lots of content. So I'd like to thank everybody who contributes articles to that. For the weekly Q&A that's hosted by Alan and myself, I'd like to thank the members who actually show up and have questions, answers, and shares of information that they have that they feel could benefit other members. So thanks very much to all of those. And I would like to thank members for being part of it all. We wouldn't be a user group if it wasn't for the fact that all of you members were coming out to meetings and being part of the user group. So now I would like to open it up for questions and comments. I don't think I remuted everybody. So if anybody has any questions or comments, you can unmute yourself or enter something into the chat window. And we'll give it a minute or so for anybody to contribute there. And I don't see any comments in the chat. Mark, question from Mark. Yeah, any word on in-person meetings? No, the church has yet to decide that they will welcome people back to the facility. So that will be the next thing that will be, we can't do anything until they decide. So any further word on that, we will get out information as quickly as we possibly can, through the announcement list, through the newsletter and the website. We'll get out any information that we can. Any other final questions before we wrap up the AGM? Okay, in terms of official closing, does anybody want to move that we close the AGM?
I move that.
Okay, moved by Alan, seconded by anybody?
I'll second it.
Okay, who was that to second?
Timothy.
Yep. Timothy. Yes, thank you, Timothy.
You're
okay,
welcome.
With that, we will close off the AGM and we'll move on to the main presentation for tonight. So, let me just bring up something here. I'd like to welcome Heather Oakley and Mike Moore from the Ottawa branch of the Ontario Genealogical Society. Mike retired from the Canadian Forces in 2004 after 32 years service. He volunteers with the Ottawa branch of the Ontario Genealogical Society and is the provincial coordinator for the Society's indexing project, the Ontario Name Index, or TONI. Mike has been tracing his roots for about 40 years using computers and the internet to help with his research in recent years. Heather Oakley has been an active volunteer in the Ottawa genealogical community since 1988. She has been a board member of the Ottawa branch most of that time. Heather has assisted in organizing of many genealogy special events. She's currently part of the board of directors for Ontario Ancestors, Ontario Genealogical Society. She is enthusiastic about preserving heritage and researching her ancestors. Mike says, I don't know how many times I've heard someone say, I wish I had known that when I started my genealogy. He and Heather developed the presentation for tonight, Getting Started in Genealogical Research. The deck from tonight's presentation, along with the document listing resources, will be available within a couple of days on our website. And with that, I would like to hand it over to Mike and Heather to take over the presentation. Thanks for coming.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you for having us.
Let's go a couple of my lines there, but we'll get off here.
Okay, cheers.
So there's considerable interest in family history these days, and as more and more information is being made available online, it's become even easier to research without leaving your home. But the basics remain the same. And as Chris said, we'll be standing around at events or hosting a table and after a meeting, and somebody will come up and say, I wish I knew that when I started. So that was the justification for putting this presentation together. There is no right way to do genealogy, but there are better ways, and one can learn from those who have gone ahead. As mentioned, this is a presentation that's based on a course that was developed by the Ontario Genealogical Society. Heather and I have just borrowed it, so we'll just go ahead. Feel free to ask questions as we go along. Heather's going to monitor the chat window to see what we've got. And there we go.
Okay, welcome again, everyone, tonight. We're glad you're here. One of the first authors of genealogy books in Canada was Angus Baxter, and he said, the most important rule is never believe anything you are told about your family unless it can be proved, and never make an assumption unless it's backed up by solid evidence.
This is where genealogy begins. Proving that an ancestor belongs to your line is easier done by going backwards, fact by fact, event by event, using deaths, marriages, and births. Other resources such as census records are documents that bring the families together. Why work backwards? It's simple math. You have two parents who each have two parents, so you got four grandparents, eight grandparents, great-great-grandparents. If you start at a possible ancestor and work forward, you've got an awful lot of children to may have. I have my great-great-great-grandparents had nine children. You'd have to investigate every one of those to find out if the line was connected to you. So start with yourself and work back. It's just a lot easier.
And as you can see, we have a golden rule for research, which applies to almost every endeavor. If you remember this rule, it'll help assure systematic, accurate, and organized genealogical results. For your information, legal documents have a slightly different definition in genealogy. Legal documents include birth, baptismal, marriage, burial, and death records from a church register. It also includes the birth, marriage, and death records held by government or transferred to government archives. It includes death certificates from funeral homes and wills that are probated. But never assume the legal information is correct. Events such as births have been incorrectly registered, and scribes in government offices have incorrectly copied documents such as birth certificates. To err is human.
So we're assuming that you're planning to actually do something with all this research. You want to put it in some format rather than have your research papers thrown out by the next generation, which is often the fact. There's no guarantee that your descendants will wish to sort out your files and carry on your research. And we get calls all the time from people saying, I've got 8 boxes that my mother did over her lifetime. Would you like them? And we have to say, sorry, we can't do much with those.
Tonight, we're going to bring you through genealogical research in 12 easy steps. I want you to understand that the basic basis of genealogy started on paper, so sometimes we will be talking about paper forms. We will also talk about computer stuff, but you got to remember paper forms are the basis of everything. And research is easier if you follow this 12-step process. And you start with yourself.
Most genealogists use a British standard for writing down dates, for example, 30 September 1861. This means you avoid the confusion that happens when you write a date down in numbers only. What is, 2/5/1861? There are a number of genealogical software programs on the market if you prefer creating electronic records, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. As Heather mentioned, the basis is paper, or at least that's the way we're going to work it. And essentially that the computer just does what the paper would do. You want to use forms like family group sheets and pedigree sheets to organize and record the responses from the questions that you've asked yourself on this sheet here.
You always work from the known to the unknown, so you always work backwards, and you start with yourself, as we said, then you go on to your parents and your grandparents. Be aware that the term parent is used for a blood relative. If step-parents are involved, this point should be clarified in your records. A second marriage should be on a second chart with the children of the step-parent listed on the chart. Each marriage should be clearly differentiated on a separate chart. In genealogy, we usually record women by their maiden names. So if someone was born Nancy Smith and they married George Brown, she becomes Nancy Smith Brown. But if she decides to get married a third time to Joe Harding, her name becomes Nancy Smith Brown Harding, and so on through the generations.
You want to make sure that you record everything when you're looking at a record. Use the standard forms as much as possible. Attach the rest of the information. But write it down because you never know when you're going to realize that piece of information is what you need to break through a brick wall.
The other thing you need to do is interview relatives. Another question we, or another comment we hear at genealogy events is, I wish I had thought to ask my grandmother. It is often the small details, these seemingly insignificant relationships and pieces of information that can help break down age-old brick walls. More importantly, these small details also allow researchers to connect with their ancestors on a more personal level. Rather than just recording dates and names, which, yes, are also important, genealogists should aim to learn more about the lives of their family members. Many genealogical societies, blogs, and family history sites provide lists of open-ended questions you can use in an oral interview. Some of them are like, can you tell me about the day your first child was born? What was a typical family dinner like? Don't limit yourself to static interview questions. Show old photographs and documents, as they may spark new stories and new insights into your family.
The second step is to locate any family documents, such as family Bibles, copies of obituaries, baptismal, marriage, or burial service programs, birth, death, and marriage certificates, even family histories. Now, I know most of us in Ottawa probably didn't grow up here, came here to work for the government, but if you're lucky enough to have an ancestral home, maybe that's where your information is. Or again, check with your ancestors, your parents, grandparents. One of the most important bits of knowledge for genealogical research is knowing the location where events took place. Family documents or even oral history may provide these location clues.
The documents and sources of information you find for your family differ from family to family. Some of the items you might find are autograph books or books that were won as a prize, so you can check the inscription or the flyleaf. You might find certificates from the military, schools, churches, jobs, cookbooks, diaries, journals, photo albums, all may offer you information. And of course, there's the important papers like wills, titles, and deeds. Even jewelry can offer you genealogical clues, because pins, ID bracelets, charm bracelets, lockets may have an inscription or something that can point you into the direction you need for your research. Trophies, silver trays, and mugs were very popular as gifts and may give you genealogical clues. Of course, any old family letters, postcards, special occasion cards, funeral or memorial cards are useful, as well as the regular birth, marriage, and death certificates, but don't forget scrapbooks and newspaper clippings. Always be ready to discover valuable information in the most unlikely place.
Now you're going to move outside. Where you begin your outside research will depend on your ancestors' ethnic background, the era in which they arrived in Canada, the type of records that are available for researching. In some cases, a lot of research can be done in other countries without even leaving Canada. You'll need a good guide for genealogical research for a particular area. It can save you time in looking for the records. It will describe the location of the records, whether the records actually exist, and if they don't, what alternative records are they? These guides can be for a whole country, a state, a province, at a municipal level, or a government, like a township. You find these guides by checking with the local genealogical groups, getting on mail lists or Facebook pages for those groups, online bookstores, check with the reference librarian in the local library of the area, attend a local genealogical group meeting. Of course, that'll have to wait till after the pandemic. And ask there if somebody is researching in the same area or has some suggestions for research guides.
And for anyone that was interested on that last slide, it was a photo of the City of Ottawa Archives, where our organization has our library. Of course, it's not open right now, but it is open to the public if you're looking for books. The fourth in the 12 easy steps is work backward in time from the known to the unknown. I know we've said that before, but it's very important. Do not try and paste your family into another family line without proof. Try to work forward from what you perceive to be, trying to work forward from some notable person to yourself is not an effective way to do your research. The number of lines that stem from this ancestor could be mind-boggling, as we mentioned before, with Mike's great-great-great-grandparents and their 9 kids.
Now you want to move on to the official records. These are usually accurate for the event being recorded, but in some cases, the people may not have told the truth about their age when getting married, for example. Some of these documents are missing, and the start dates vary around the world. Other information may be secondary or third hand. The informant for their parents' death would not have been at the parents' birth, for example, so how do they know their parents' birth date? Ontario's records start in June 1869, but the early years are very spotty, up till about 1900. It's really hit and miss trying to find a birth, marriage, or death record in Ontario. As I said, other countries, other provinces, the dates are also different, so you need to check the local society to find out when they actually begin.
The sixth step in your genealogical research is to check for church or parish records. Church records exist for the time periods before civil registration. And they include birth or baptismal records, marriage records, marriage bans, marriage licenses. No, that's only civil. Sorry. And death records or burial records. And many of the churches have archives where they've centralized their older records. And that's a picture of the Anglican Church archives, correct, Mike?
Correct, downtown. Yep. Census records are helpful for determining where an ancestor lived and for assembling the family. But you have to be careful about ages and the spelling, as you don't know who provided the information. Did Dad remember the ages of all his kids when the census taker came knocking? Or did the information get collected from a neighbor because nobody was home when the fellow rode around to get the information? You're not sure, so take it with a grain of salt.
Now we're going to show you some actual census records, and here's an example of something you might run across. I know it doesn't look too clear, but that's just the way they come.
So this is my translation of what the enumerator actually wrote down on that page. As you see, it's McClellan with L-E-L, Kathleen. He did get daughter there, which, you know, hopefully you can decipher. She's single and born in December 1899.
But that's what the census says. The second image on your screen now is the actual birth registration. And the birth registration, you can see the differences. This is what she was called on her birth registration, Kathleen McClellan. This is a minor error that you will find compared to some of the other errors that you can find. But it shows you have to be very careful about spelling. Don't ignore a record because the name is not spelt the way we spell it.
After you've looked at the census records, move on to other government records. Records are collected by all levels of government for various purposes, as you probably are well aware. These records can include things like voters' lists, tax assessment records, wills, health information. But you do have to remember that governmental records were not, unfortunately, not created for genealogists, but they may provide some useful information. An example is property tax records. They tell you where a family was living and how large their property was at that time.
I'm sure you as computer users know that not everything is on the internet. Your ninth step is to research in libraries, archives, and museums. More and more information is becoming available online, either as indexes or digitized records, but a great deal remains on shelves or filing cabinets in museums, big and small, archives, libraries, historical and genealogical societies. And remember, even if the information is in print form or on the internet, doesn't mean that it's accurate. Go back to the original source or a digitized image of the original source to verify the information. If you research on one of the websites such as Ancestry or Family Search, you usually can look at the actual images. Don't rely on the index or transcriptions when you can look at the original document. You will find that there's much more information there, as well as be able to make a determination on how accurate the index is.
The internet has become a tremendous aid to genealogy, but you have to be careful about the information. There's no control on what goes up there, as I'm sure you're well aware. And in many cases, you have no idea where that information came from. It could be accurate, but unless they've given you their source, how do you really know?
There's some better sites for searching for genealogical information, and most of this information will be in the handout that Chris will put on your website in a few days. Some websites require a fee or a subscription, and some archive websites really have a lot of information that you should check out, and it's usually free. The last item on this list is Cindy's List. And you're thinking, who's Cindy? Cindy's List is a goldmine for finding websites about every aspect of genealogy, from reading old handwriting to dating old photographs. And it's all grouped by subject or locality, and there's over 300,000 links there. You can really get lost in Cindy's List.
So a good researcher always goes back to the primary sources to check the accuracy of the information provided by others. Anyone can put information up on the web, and it's very easy for false information to be spread. Some of it intentional, some of it accidental. I posted my family tree onto Ancestry, and my ancestors lived in Simcoe County, Ontario. Somebody copied that information, but they were too lazy to write out the word county. So now my ancestors live in Simcoe, Ontario, which is a town about 100 miles away from Simcoe County. And we have a number of those places in Ontario, a couple of Perths, a couple of Lanarks, and probably several others that I can't remember. The National Institution of Genealogical Societies says, don't take information online as fact. Use the information only as a pointer towards the truth. Remember that you don't know exactly where the information you find came from. So as Heather said, if there's an image of the document up there, that's a good source. But if it's a transcription or just an index to it, you want to try and find the original document.
The 10th step in our genealogy research odyssey is to network with other genealogists. As mentioned, Mike and I are members of the Ottawa branch of Ontario Ancestors. Ontario Ancestors, or the Ontario Genealogical Society, has, I think, 34 branches and SIGs. SIG is special interest group, and they're usually about a research topic, like British home children. And the rest of the branches are usually geographic in nature. There are other genealogy groups out there other than those aligned with OGS, but that's where you should network with other genealogists. There's two major genealogy organizations in Ottawa. Ottawa Branch is the one we're representing right now. And you can go to our website and see about upcoming meetings. All our meetings at the moment are on Zoom and free for anyone to attend.
The other major group in the city is the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa. I wish they'd picked a shorter name. Many of these organizations will have a members-only area, which means you have to join in order to get into their information, which means they get a little bit of money from you to join. Others offer courses or webinars. There are also many seminars. We normally have a Genorama in the spring. Bafisco, as we call the other group, have a fall conference, usually in September. And there's larger events like the Ontario Ancestors Annual Conference, the largest in Canada, or Roots Tech down in the States, the Family History Fair from the UK, and there's several others. They've certainly grown during the pandemic, with a lot of these being online.
The 11th step in your genealogy odyssey is to leave tracks wherever you go. Some places you visit, you can leave contact information if you're researching a certain name or family. In many local history libraries, they maintain a file of researchers. You can put surname entries in databases on the computer, which, that was pretty silly to say to you guys, using an email address as a contact. Some websites allow you to leave a query with contact information for others to see, and you'll never know what information you can get back.
We mentioned this before, but you always want to copy the information that you find. It may be easier, to take a picture with your camera. Always check with the facility that you're in, because some do have restrictions on using cameras or even handheld scanners. But worst case, you want to write it down, because you'll never know when it becomes important. Keep track of where you found the information. That will save you a lot of work if you need to consult the source again. And as well, when you go to write your family history, having the source information will make footnoting an easier task. Don't forget to copy file numbers and reel numbers when using microfilm or image identification when you're online. This is called citing your sources and is an important part of a quality family history. And I can promise you, if you don't cite your sources, you will be sorry later on.
Cite your sources could be a presentation in itself, but I want to emphasize how important it is to cite your sources. If you plan to pass on your work to another family member or a genealogy society, they may want to check your data. But probably more importantly, you will want to look at a source at a later date. You will be surprised at how often you will want to recheck something in a year or two. You will receive a piece of information from someone and it conflicts with what you've already got. Well, you need to know where you found your first piece of information, so you have to cite your source. I don't know how many times I've heard somebody say that they wished they had cited their sources from the beginning. Now, genealogical evidence identifies relationships and individuals. You do this by linking the ancestor with the exact location and time period and applying this to the key events in their life, like birth, marriage, and death, which is usually abbreviated as BMDs, if you ever see that. I've heard it called hatch, match, and dispatch, or bred, wed, and dead. But those are the pieces of information you need. And proof is defined as a conclusion supported by three things. I don't know why I have mumble mouth tonight. Please excuse it. You need to have thorough research and documentation. You need to have reliable evidence correctly interpreted. And you need a well-reasoned analysis of the information. As I said, this could be a topic on its own, so I'm not going to bore you much more. It's just that citation of sources is essential to the evaluation of your evidence. It needs enough information to identify the sources and where to locate them. And consistency in citing your sources is usually expected. If you want to join an organization like the United Empire Loyalists, the Mayflower Society, or even one of Ontario Ancestors Heritage Societies, they will simply not take your word for everything. They want to check your sources. If they cannot find your sources, they will likely reject your application.
Getting organized is always important. You can save yourself countless hours and dollars by being organized in both your research and your results. So save your family artifacts, photos, certificates, diaries, etc., in a way that they will last for future generations. Look into archivally safe storage options. Don't just stick them in an envelope and shove them in the cupboard. Otherwise, they will deteriorate. And of course, if for those of you who are doing this on the computer, which I suspect will be most of us, don't forget to back up your data. Redundant and separate copies are essential to ensure your research information lasts as long as possible.
I don't think we need to tell this group that computers can help. But anyways, there are a number of genealogical software packages that can make things easier for you. Computers can help you in your research and doing computers and genealogy and how they can help you. There's very many ways, and that could be a course in itself, and we're just going to touch the surface of that for you tonight.
Entire books have been written about how to select the right genealogy program, but it comes down to what is right for you. The best genealogy software depends on personal preference. Almost all the programs do a good job of letting you enter your family data and viewing it in a variety of formats. Prices range from free to about $70 Canadian. Options are a bit more limited for the Mac, but there's or handhelds, but there is still software out there. The best way to choose the right genealogy program, whether it is your first time or you're looking for a replacement for your existing program, make a list of your requirements and then try out the programs which seem to meet those requirements. Most genealogy software vendors have a free trial or a demo version available for just that purpose. And if they don't, they've probably got a money back guarantee. And if they don't, then maybe you don't want to try that one.
Oh, this is a computer literate group. I want you to understand that reputable genealogy software will have something called GEDCOM. When looking for a genealogy program, keep one thing foremost, GEDCOM or another transfer format. GEDCOM stands for Genealogical Data Communications. I had to read that aloud. I read that out because I've heard it so many years but never really knew what it stood for. It's a standard for transmitting genealogy data between different types of software so that the names, dates, and places get to the right spot in the new program. There are newer versions of the standard, but the critical thing to remember is to use a program that is GEDCOM compatible. You can send information to a cousin and vice versa without having to type in all the data again. Another good reason for GEDCOM is the ability to change programs if you don't like or outgrow your first choice. It is not perfect, as not all software uses it well and completely, but you get the basics. Make sure the program you choose has the capability to handle things like conflicting dates and locations, as well as alternate spellings of names. Make sure that it will record all the necessary information about sources and repositories in its database, not as simple text notes. If you want to go back at some future date and double check a particular document, will you be able to determine which document is in question? This is also going back to cite your sources. Or where that document is located? A good genealogy program will give you that information easily. If your ancestors came from a non-English speaking country, make sure that the genealogy software you select can handle those non-English alphabets. Finally, make sure the program you buy has a money-back guarantee. Since you'll probably be sitting at your computer's keyboards for many hours using a genealogy program, it's important to do a little bit of research before choosing one first. There's a number of excellent genealogy programs available today. Why use one that's second rate?
So what do you want to do with the genealogy information? Do you want to produce wall-sized trees, including photos, audio and video clips, create a family web page, or just a basic program to store names, dates, and events? Do you plan to share your research online with other family historians? As Heather mentioned, a lot of the programs will allow you to update your data online from your computer. Are you planning to write a book with the information that you enter? Some software programs offer more features for printing family history books than others. Do you prefer to use keystrokes, or do you like clicking the mouse in a box? What type of charts and reports would you like your software to be able to print? Do you want to be able to easily add in genealogy files created in other programs without any loss of data? And finally, if you're tracing your family history for eventual submission to the Latter-day Saints Church, you'll want to use a software that supports the special fields needed to document them. The Latter-day Saints are a big name in genealogy because they require their members to research their family trees, and they've contributed a lot of information that the rest of us now get to use.
This is just a list of some of the more popular genealogy software out there. The top box are those that are Windows, and the bottom box is those that are useful for the Mac. Some of these programs have a steep learning curve. Some of them do not. I can remember, I'm dating myself here, 25 years ago using the Reunion on a Mac when I didn't have my own personal computer at home and I was using a friend's Mac, and I could go back to it 6 months later and still remember how to navigate through the program. So check them all out and see what works for you.
Recent trend is building your family trees online. There are places like WikiTree, Ancestry, MyHeritage, and Family Search that have allow you to build your tree. The information is kept on the web. It may or may not be shared with others, and may or may not be open to changes by others. I don't have a whole lot of experience with these, as I keep my information on my desktop with plenty of backups, and I only upload to sites to as what we refer to as cousin bait, so that somebody can look at it and say, oops, I want to know that information, I'm related to them. Online genealogy sites have the advantage that you can collaborate or share with others on your family tree. They have varying degrees of privacy. You may want to omit data about living individuals, for example. Not everyone believes that privacy is dead. Sooner or later, you're probably going to want to produce some sort of report or chart. Most of these sites have few reports compared to the packages that you can install on your own computer. Finally, make backups of your files to your own hard drive, because as you're probably aware, websites can disappear at a moment's notice, and you don't want your stuff to disappear with it.
There are places where you can get software reviews. These are listed in the handout that Chris Taylor is going to put up, so you don't have to be writing anything down. But be wary of any software reviews, because sometimes they're not current and others may have an axe to grind. It's such a personal matter that you and the reviewer may have totally different needs and wants. I find genealogy software comparisons to be very subjective, no matter who is doing them. Wikipedia is probably as accurate as any part of Wikipedia. In other words, it's up to the people entering the information.
DNA testing for genealogy has exploded in the past few years, and it can be very useful. Most of us in the hobby are not looking to determine if we're Scottish or Italian or Native American. We are looking for relatives who match our DNA and are related to us, and with any luck, have family information to share with us. Although I usually find that it's going the other way around. One word in there, or one abbreviation, NPE, a non-paternity event, or not the parent expected. Someone who is presumed to be an individual's father is not, in fact, the biological father. Non-paternity may result from things like sperm donation, undisclosed adoptions, promiscuity, paternity fraud, sexual assault, even medical mistakes such as mix-ups during procedures such as in vitro fertilization and artificial insemination. Don't be surprised if you take a DNA test and you find somebody that you weren't expecting.
There's a couple of different kinds of DNA tests, and DNA would be another presentation all on its own, and I would not be qualified to give it. We would suggest you check out Family Research Wiki about DNA. If you want to compare genetic DNA tests, check out 7 best genetic DNA tests in January 2022 at the DNA Weekly site.
Just to cover it quickly, men have both Y-DNA and mitochondrial, or mtDNA. But they don't pass the mitochondrial on. Women have mitochondrial DNA, and they pass it on to both their children, both sexes of children. I should back up. Men pass their Y-DNA on to their sons, but not to their daughters, and they don't pass their mitochondrial on. So if you're testing, you want to make sure, particularly for women, you may want to get a brother or a male cousin who's descended from your father's brother in order to do some of these tests for you.
Okay, we're going to briefly talk about presenting and sharing your information. Some of this we've already mentioned. We said earlier that the aim of this genealogy effort by you is to record your family history for posterity. Make sure that you do have a final product to pass on to those who come after. Even if it's just a binder or a DVD or CD-ROM, whatever, that is well labeled so that people will know what it is and they won't throw it out when you pass on. You may want to put it online in a web page. There are quite a few courses offered free at this time during COVID that can tell you more about this. And if you want to get into writing a family narrative, BFISCO, the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa, the other genealogy group, has a writing group that meets monthly. Sites such as Family Search and WikiTree allow you to post a tree, and it is available for others to amend. Ancestry and MyHeritage allow you to upload a tree, but you control the content. These are intended more to help other researchers find you, as Mike called it, cousin bait. But there's other ways of presenting and sharing the information, like memory quilts. There's scrapbooking, like creative memories. You can make a fancy wall chart and frame it and keep it on the wall. You can print books or calendars with family photos and family birthdays listed on it. You can even do a scrapbook with sound clips. That sounds beyond my capability, but I bet you it's not beyond you guys. If you have a knack, which you guys probably do, or a grandchild, you can produce something in multimedia, a video, a DVD, etc.
Now, here's an example of a family history website that we've put up. This is on the Billings family, and you can find information there on it. Using the right software, it's fairly easy to do, fortunately, because I'm not into programming.
As we said, there's other ways to preserve your family history, like a scrapbook or a memory quilt. And you could make an online digital scrapbook or a photo book or even an ebook. And I was very interested to listen to one of your other presentations previously on photo books. So you've got in-house information on that.
So we're coming towards the end here. So just wanted to remind you where we're coming from, the Ontario Genealogical Society. As Heather mentioned, there are branches and special interest groups across the province. We are the largest genealogical society in Canada. And we often go by the name Ontario Ancestors because we were getting confused with the Ohio Genealogical Society at times.
Mike, why don't you talk about Tony since you're the provincial coordinator for it?
All right. So this is a name index that we've been working on for about 12 or 13 years. It's not limited to cemetery transcriptions. It includes anything that we can find with the name of an Ontario person in it. It's names of people, not places. So the source could be a branch document, a website, a microfilm, a family history, or an archive somewhere. It's an indexing project, so all it will do is point you in the right direction, point you to the source where it can be found. And it's on the public part of the OGS website so that anybody can use it. And as it says there, we recently just passed the 13 million name mark and will continue to grow, hopefully, over the years. In that case, you can do this one. Let's get the slide changed. No.
Yep.
Let's try that one.
Mike and I are co-chairing for Ontario Ancestors, their annual conference, and it will be held in June. This year it has to be virtual again because we're unsure what COVID or Omicron or whatever other Greek letter comes up. you'll get up-to-the-minute information on our conference website. This is not a free event, but you can come to the marketplace for free if you're interested. Friday night of this event, we're very excited because Library and Archives Canada and the Ottawa Public Library will present their plans for their new joint facility. And I'm not going to pronounce this right, but I'm going to try. They're calling it AD Soki. Don't ask me. It's an Anishinaabemowin word for storytelling. Again, I probably very badly mangled the pronunciation. I do not mean any offense because of my mangling. This is a new facility opening in 2026, but LAC and the Ottawa Public Library are looking for suggestions on how genealogy services should be offered to these places. And at our conference, they're going to ask conference attendees to contribute to co-designing these services by describing what their ideal service journey through the new facility might look like. And it will end with a Q&A, but we're very excited that LAC, Library and Archives Canada, and OPL, Ottawa Public Library, are doing this at our conference.
And just to put in a little plug for our own organization, these are the upcoming events. We do hold presentations every month, normally on the fourth Saturday of the month. They're still on Zoom, and we're in the same boat. We have no idea when we're going to get back into our facility. They are open to the public. Anybody can join in. They're free. Just go to our website, go to events, and you can register for the event. You can see a couple of the ones we've got coming up.
And that is the end of our formal presentation. I have been monitoring chat. Timothy, I see you had a family group chart as your background. Great. You must be into genealogy. I noticed that.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Timothy.
Oh, I am. I started in 2007 after most of my uncles and family, when my mom and dad passed. But my family came from the Toronto Peel region, and I've been to the archives down in Brampton. And if anybody has, if they know if they came from the Peel region, that includes Mississauga and Brampton, there's a section called, now I got a memory dump. Perkins Bull Collection. And in the 1930s, he hired a lot of people around to the cemeteries, writing down the inscriptions on the cemeteries, going through a lot of records that were available at the time, interviewing people about their ancestors living in that area. And he's developed a whole big section there. And I found one big chart of my family members up to the 1930s. Some of the information is right and some of the information is wrong, as you have pointed out, but it gave me a start off knowing that some of the information on those trees I knew from my own history.
Sure.
So that gave me a boost.
Great.
But I know and some of the families do have a family tree already produced. But some of my members that I know are not on that tree because some had moved by that time from the 1820s to the States. So, and of course, there might have been family fights and nobody wanted to talk to anybody else. So it's like you said, it's a hit and a miss. But he does have a lot of information on all the families that were living there.
Yeah, that's a good facility. That was Brian Gilchrist's facility, I believe, Heather. He worked at
Talked with them a few times when I went to visit.
Yeah, he was one of the top genealogists in the province. Passed away a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But a lovely okay. man and gave great presentations.
Yes. Oh yeah, he gave me a good help.
Great. Another question?
Oh yeah, I got a couple here.
Okay.
Somebody was asking about how to write down the information. Tom Torache, sorry if I mangled that. Genealogy research is usually organized by a family group sheet and then a pedigree chart. Now, a pedigree chart, you can understand it's just like pedigrees for purebred dogs, as an example. Family group sheets give you the parents and children. Now, those are paper documents, but most genealogy software is kind of based on those, and that's how you do your reporting. So those are the best things for writing down. Like if you were going to visit someone and they were giving you family information, you have a blank paper, family group sheet in front of you, and you start writing the stuff down, and then you can translate it to your genealogy software program when you get home.
I presume most software would provide you the ability to print out these blank forms too, huh?
In various ways, yes.
Yeah, they're also available. You could Google them on. You'll find hundreds of copies of them, Chris.
Okay.
And again,
on the handout.
If depending, I mean, I'm not into a tablet or a smartphone very well, so the time it takes me to type something into a, you know, when I'm out interviewing somebody or talking to somebody, I'd much better with a clipboard and a piece of paper. I can scribble it down and transfer it back. Again, making sure you can actually read your writing. You can, you know what you've done. I mentioned about, the dates, making sure they're clear, even places. Make sure you're clear as to where it is. If you're researching somebody in the States, there's only so many place names that are available, and there's, you need to know the place, often the township, the county, and the state. Google Germantown, Pennsylvania sometime, and you'll find out there's about 20 of them. And I have relatives in one of them. So, you want to make sure you've got the information. It's clear. Again, if you can, if you're looking at documents or something, maybe you can take a picture with your camera, and then it's even easier. You just transcribe it when you get home. Or if you've got a handheld scanner of some sort, phones are getting so much better these days, a lot of them do all that on their own.
Tom also asked about DNA. Again, check our handout. It's got the different companies that offer and how you can choose one. I don't want to talk about it because I can't even say that kind of DNA.
There is a DNA interest group in town, special interest group as part of the British Isles Family History Society. And I can't, they meet on a Saturday. Most of our stuff's on a Saturday. But if you check on their website, and again, if you look, bifhsgo.com, I think it is, or just British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa, it will list it with the information. I believe you need to be invited to it. And again, they're doing it by Zoom, and it's, some of it's basic. Some of it's a little further advanced, and some of it's well over my head. And I've had my first DNA test done about 14 years ago. But it's another one that's making great advances, but, neither Heather and I are experts in that area.
Also, if you join Ontario Ancestors, they now have a SIG, Special Interest Group, on genetic genealogy that just started up. We've talked about the LGS. we all used to know them as Mormons, but now they like to be called Latter-day Saints, which is LDS. And as Mike previously mentioned, they have more information on genealogy than anyone else in the world. And I'm not kidding. And all their stuff is available freely on familysearch.org. That's digitized. But they have so many resources available to researchers. You need to check them out. And you can visit local LDS churches that have a library. The one in Ottawa on Prince of Wales does. So you can go there.
Not until after they reopen.
True. Yes, there's family trees on Ancestry.com and Family Search. For those of you that want to do some research without paying Ancestry, Ottawa Public Library computers, you can access the library edition of Ancestry there.
But you have to go into a library branch. Now, they were allowing it from home for a while, but that ended at the end of December. So, but go into a library and you get free access.
Tom also mentioned a complete computerized record of families of the province of Quebec over almost 400 years. Well, I don't know if it's complete, but I believe you're referencing the Drouin collection. That's D-R-O-I-N. If you want to know more about that, I would visit the Quebec Family History Society website. That's QFHS, Quebec Family History Society. It's a great source that is very useful to people of Roman Catholic faith in Quebec, and it's a huge collection.
They have a little bit on some of the other non-Anglican and non-Roman Catholic churches, and they do have a little bit from Eastern Ontario as well, but it is primarily Quebec. It was done as, I believe it was somebody named Drouin who started this years ago, and it's been carried on documenting all the church baptismal, marriage, and burial records.
Someone mentioned the software program GRAMPS, G-R-A-M-P-S. I've heard of it, but I have no personal knowledge of it, so I can't tell you anything about it.
Yeah, likewise, I don't think it – was it on our list?
No.
I don't think it's one of the – would be considered one of the top programs. And again, I don't know of anybody who actually uses it.
Neither do I. And the LDS had created a software called Personal Ancestral File, or PAF, P-A-F, which was free and was a great software, but they no longer support it. Some people still use it, but it's no longer supported. So the longest verified family tree, Tom, you asked difficult questions. I would say something of British royalty.
Yeah, if you're descended from royalty, you can probably get back a fair distance. I think people have actually been able to get back to Charlemagne. But again, you've got to be royalty because they were the only people that were documented. And my ancestors who were ag labs or agricultural laborers in southern England, there's little record of them beyond early 1800s. Now, again, in other countries, I did see a show on, Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates. Interviews and they do research on celebrities, usually two or three each program. He did a Chinese fella, Chinese chef, and his tree they discovered went back several thousand years, because the Chinese are excellent at keeping records. And in fact, there was a carving, and I forget what they call it, but basically a large pole type thing where the family tree had been carved into. A lot of them were lost when the communists took over, but his was retained, and they had a picture of it. And when he rolled out his chart, most people, you get a genealogy chart and it goes wide and not very high. His was narrow and high because it went back. It was the longest chart they had ever produced, the number of generations. And I can't remember how many great, great, greats were involved in that branch of the family.
Mark had a funny DNA story about a pair of identical twins in Ottawa that submitted DNA and came back with completely different DNA profiles. Yeah, that would be funny. What you have to realize is when they analyze the DNA, the centimorgans, is that the right word? Anyways, they use different mathematical equations to determine ancestry. And each company uses a different algorithm. That's the word I was looking for. Another thing I wouldn't be able to talk about, math, algorithms. Woo. But that's why you get slightly different results from different companies, and also which type of DNA your
which committee test for. Done.
You tested on, that's what.
But if the DNA doesn't lie, unlike the paper trail, if the DNA says you're not related, then you can be darn sure you're not related. So it's, you know, be prepared for a surprise. I've tested a number of my relatives, and one of the things I warn them is be careful, you know, before you say yes, you know, you'll allow me to send a test in for you. Be aware that maybe the answer comes back might not be what you're expecting. So far I've had no serious results, but, you know, some people have. Friend of mine here got contacted by somebody who turned out to actually be his brother's or his cousin's illegitimate child that nobody knew existed. It was from his younger days, but, you know, that happens. Or it turns out that, you know, the non-paternal paternity event, the father is not the father that was expected. Usually it's the father, because generally you know who the mother was. You know, or it could be there's things like adoptions. You know, and sometimes nobody's told. And if your parents have, you know, or whoever, you know, the adopted parents have passed on without telling, you know, they adopted the baby at birth or, you know, very young, never told them. And all of a sudden you discover that, hey, I'm, you know, great folks, you know, I had a good life, but you're not my parents, and I'd like to find my adopted parents. We see a lot of that. There's actually a woman in town who spends a lot of time working with adoptees, tracing their, or trying to find their family through DNA.
Somebody, Tom again, mentioned Canada Archives. Well, it's Library and Archives Canada, or LAC, here in Ottawa at 385 Wellington. The LAC has, and how do I put this? It predates computers. So it has all the censuses from across Canada on microfilm. Most of that kind of information you can now get online and other sites. But they have other things there. You have to visit their website to see what they've got. You can get the World War I military file of one of your ancestors. Or depending on how far along they've gotten the digitization, you might be able to find the World War II file on an ancestor. So there's lots of stuff at the LAC. Not all of it is digitized. Some of it is. But there's all sorts of good stuff there. Jocelyn mentioned Beechwood Cemetery. Beechwood Cemetery is now the National Military Cemetery. Is that what it's called, Mike?
I believe so.
But Beechwood Cemetery's been around for a long time. Beechwood Cemetery used to offer walking tours of the cemetery, which sounds weird, but give it a minute, with a subject. I was involved twice. Once I talked about famous women buried at cemetery at Beechwood. Sometimes they do one on famous writers that are buried at Beechwood. Beechwood Cemetery, yes, is very interesting, and they have 360 different kinds of hostas. So it's a great place to visit. I know cemeteries sound weird to visit, but some of them are beautiful. Now, let's see.
I think somebody commented about cemeteries early on there. And yes, cemeteries are a great source of information. We have done a number of the Ontario cemeteries in the Tony Index, but not all of them. Most of the cemeteries in Ontario, at least southern Ontario, have been transcribed and indexed by one of the branches, but it may not be digital. It may not be up on in Tony, so you need to look at it. But yeah, I've found a lot of information in cemeteries. Used to drag my kids around to them. They were much better at running around looking for names and, Dad, come on over here. I found somebody. So yeah, they're another good source that we haven't talked about, but I think somebody commented that there are several websites now that do cemeteries, Billion Graves, Find a Grave, Canadian Headstones, the Canadian Gen Web has a project as well to do a lot of the cemeteries and but just be aware again they may not be complete. So when you search a cemetery, the name may not be there because all these things are done by volunteers. And in some cases, locally, we have a fellow, Cliff Siebel, who goes around and he photographs from one end of the cemetery to the other and uploads them. But sometimes somebody goes in and they photograph their family, does half a dozen pictures, and then uploads them. And you think, oh, geez, that's a pretty small cemetery. There's only six people buried there. Really, there's 2,000, but they didn't bother taking the pictures because they weren't interested in it.
Also, you have to remember that not everyone buried in a cemetery has a headstone. In the case, and I'll use Beechwood Cemetery as an example, they have burial registers that list all the people that are buried there, not just those with headstones. And sometimes cemeteries have records for these non-headstone people that you can check out.
Some cemeteries don't, because they're no longer, either they've lost them or the cemetery, you know, who runs the cemetery? Cemetery may have been abandoned. Sometimes we actually, a number of years ago, our coordinator got a phone call from somebody that said they just found a paper bag full of burial records in their basement because their father used to look after a cemetery and were we interested in them? And we said, yes, but that's, you know, these would have been lost forever. Because that's all he did is he took them, instead of filing them, he put them in a paper bag. And when he passed away, nobody knew where they were.
Mark is asking about passenger ship lists. For Canada, you have to remember that anyone of British, Scottish, Irish, Welsh descent was considered part of the country, so they're not on ship lists. And most of the passenger ship lists in Canada start about 1865. So if they came earlier than that, it's a little harder to find. You can check Pier 21, which is in Halifax, but they have an online presence that talk about ship passengers lists. In the States, they're more useful if your ancestor came through the States. And remember, not everyone that came to Canada came through a Canadian port. They may have come through New York. So you can check out Ellis Island and Castle Garden.
And there was, in Canada, there was no requirement to keep the ship's list or to file it. So often cases, it, you know, got turned over and used for the ship going back the other way, or maybe it became toilet paper or something. And it wasn't until fairly recently that, as Heather mentioned, anybody coming from the British Commonwealth, there were no records kept because we were all part of the Commonwealth until, I think it was 49 or so when we actually started tracking our own immigration. And immigration from the U.S., the borders were wide open for a long time. So you may find some ancestry has things like American records, but most of those are probably the 1900s, 1920s and on. And of course, remember that if you lived along the St. Lawrence, when the river froze, you went across the river to visit your relatives, and you didn't go through a checkpoint to get across there. They probably still do that, as a matter of fact. But, so there's plenty of places where, back and forth across the border. And as Heather mentioned, my relatives arrived in 1820 from Scotland. They went to, if my record research is correct, they actually landed in Baltimore, spent a couple years in the States before coming north. Others came in through Montreal or Quebec City. You've got to, again, the records, that's the beauty of this hobby. You can spend hours researching.
I think you spend a lifetime.
Yes.
Somebody mentioned heraldry and coats of arms. Coats of arms were issued to a certain family member. Just because your last name is the same as their last name doesn't mean you're entitled to use the coat of arms. But you can see more about this on the Canadian Heraldry Society website. Let's see, what else is in here? Oh, again, talking about names. Yes, spelling can be very widely, but also there is the stories of people arriving in North America and anglicizing or localizing their name. They may have been Greenstein and changed it to Green. That's a very bad example, but you know what I'm getting at. So just, keep that in mind.
Oh, I had a question a little earlier. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, the other thing with names is, of course, our Francophone neighbors, when they moved further west or down to the States, some of those names got distorted. And I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, there was a American professional football player called Tom Tebow. And I swore I knew how to spell his name until I saw it on the back of his shirt. And it was T-E-B-O-W. Now, I will bet you that he originally, he had an ancestor from Quebec who was a Tebow, spelled the traditional way, but he got down to the States and somebody wrote it down for them. And again, the other thing, remember, with names, it was only about 100 years ago that spelling of names became important, around about the First World War, when people started worrying about how names were actually spelled. Prior to that, they spelled them the way they sounded. And now I have not actually checked this out yet, but I'm told that when William Shakespeare wrote his will, he spelled his own name 8 different ways. It didn't matter because most people were illiterate, and so it was the sound that mattered. And sometimes it was the clerk who was a little literate, and he would spell the name the way he wanted to spell it. So, you know, somebody like Chris, you know, it could have been T-A-I-L-O-R, because that's how he thought Taylor should be spelled. Yeah. You know, and the names would get passed down, and eventually they would be spelled, you know, they started to be consistent. As I said, around the First World War, when some of the records started getting serious.
I think in the list that you might have skipped over, Susan had a question about suggestions for linking old photographs. She had inherited old family photos. Do the genealogical software typically allow you to import scans of photos?
Most of them do. Certainly the current ones will allow you to attach exhibits, you know, either photographs mainly or other documents. You can link them to individuals, to events, etc. So yeah, and in some cases, you know, you can link, you know, actual individuals in there. There's a way to do that. Some of the fancier programs, you know, similar to what a Facebook does with tagging people. But it depends on the program. And again, we're getting a little further than Heather and I are competent at. But certainly you can link any of those programs that we mentioned. I am confident will allow you to attach outside documents to photographs, wills, even, you know, a PDF file or a Word doc or something like that.
I would guess this might become important where if we go back to your example where you had to interpret handwriting, and if you can actually have a photograph of it that you can attach as well, that somebody else might say, well, no, this is really, and they'll point out that maybe you interpreted it wrong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jocelyn brings up a very important point. In order to protect oneself against ID thieves, what should and should not be published? I don't know much about identity theft, but in the genealogy world, the usual thing is do not post any information on living individuals. But of course, you know, if your cousin died at the age of 21, okay, they're dead, but you don't want to put too current an information on there. I know my grandma died when she was 96 in 1995. That I may put up there, but I don't think I'd put anything on my aunts and uncles that have passed away since. That is a personal preference there.
And websites like Ancestry will not display information on people that are still alive. People get around that by not putting dates up there, so the computer doesn't know. But generally, yeah, if you want to be careful. Now, I'm not aware of any ID theft from a genealogy program, or, you know, genealogy people probably exists, but most of the information that I've got on recent people is probably public knowledge anyways. There's more information available out there. The identity thieves aren't wasting their time going through people's genealogies when they can find it a lot quicker elsewhere. They go to Facebook and find the people who've posted, oh, look at the picture of my grandchild who was born, you know, February 6, 2002, and weighed 7 pounds, and his name so-and-so. Oh, well, here we got some information. I even get information on some of my relatives that way.
And I think I've addressed most of the questions, Chris.
I think so. I've been monitoring as well, and I think all the questions, there's lots of comments in there. There's been some people posting links to different sources and so forth. So if anybody's interested, for sure check out the chat. That'll get posted to our website as well. We've had a lot of kudos for a great presentation, and I would like to echo that. I mean, this was a fantastic presentation. I guess one question I have on that virtual conference, do you have a price on it yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
But it'll probably, most probably be under $100.
Okay.
And that gives you access to 29 presentations.
Wow. Okay.
And at the moment, we believe that all the presentations will be up for a month after the event. So you don't have to be there in person. They'll be recorded so you can see them for the month after.
Yeah,
it's held over a weekend. So it'll be Saturday, Sunday, 9 till 5, with two streams of presentations. So you can't actually attend everyone anyways. Right. But then said the recordings will be available for about a month afterwards.
At that sort of price, I think anybody who is interested in getting started in genealogy, that probably would be a really great resource for them to take part on, take part in.
Some of the lectures will be a higher level. If you're brand new and you want to get started, it may not be the best place to jump in. I'm not sure whether the school boards are still offering basic genealogy courses. We've not done that for a few years. There are things that, there are ways to learn a little better. I mean, we gave a quick rundown today, but, there are places that do have some beginner's courses that, may run a couple of, and certainly online, you can probably find stuff online. There's a Scottish University, I believe it's the University of Strathclyde.
Yes.
That offers a free genealogy course. I should have thrown that in there.
I've never taken it in there.
Okay. But it does come highly recommended.
And the other thing you have to remember, genealogy conferences, yes, we're talking about finding ancestors. But some people attend because they're interested in a certain period of history. Though it's not finalized yet, we're going to have someone speaking on the War of 1812. So, there's all sorts of stuff there. The other thing is it's a little harder in a virtual conference, but in-person conferences, beginners were welcomed and assisted and all that kind of thing.
Great.
Now, Vivian's just made a comment about an earlier speaker. I believe that was Doug Gray that you had a couple of years ago. I talked to him about it. Doug ran our computer group, so he was probably more technical at the time.
Okay, I'll try and dig up the information on that on our past speakers' website, and maybe I'll include that into the chat window or something like that when that gets posted to our website, if I can find it. So additional information for sure. Oh, okay, 2016. I will find that information, and I'll get it included in the chat file. So, we are running just a little over, so that's great. I would like to extend my sincere thanks for Mike and Heather. I think this was a fantastic presentation. We've had a lot of comments in the chat window, people saying that it was a great presentation. They really enjoyed it and got a lot of really good information out of that. So I'd like to extend my thanks for you to preparing this presentation and coming out and giving it to us this evening. I think our members received it quite well. I think it was a highlight for sure. So I'd like to remind everybody that the deck as well as the resource list will be going up on our website along with the audio track that we've recorded and the contents of the chat window. So with that, I think I would like to call the meeting to a close. So thank you all for attending. And we'll see you next week at Q&A, hopefully a lot of you. And our next meeting will be the second Wednesday of March. So thanks very much for attending, everybody.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you for all your comments, people. That was wonderful.
Yes, thank you.
Great. Good night.
Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Don't forget to turn off the recording.
Thanks.